All right, today is January 14th, 2013. This is my first oral history interview of 2013. This is the follow-up interview with Mary Beth Plain. We're here at her home in Madison. And my name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Mary Beth, for recording quality purposes, could you state your name and spell your last name?
Sure. Mary Beth Plain, P-L-A-N-E.
Okay. Just going to turn this up just a skosh. All right. When the recorder's off, we were talking about that there didn't appear to be much, if any, follow-up to do with the from the first interview.
Okay.
I want to start with something on your CV here about the, it says faculty-teachers for tomorrow, UW Department of Family Medicine. Looks like it's something that you started towards the end of the HEART grant. So.
Oh, right. Yeah, while I was on the HEART grant, there was a department grant that was given to us by HRSA, the Health Services Resources Association, Research Association. That's a part of NIH. And they funded the department to work with our, mainly with our faculty that are extensions of the department who work with residents and medical students outside of Madison.
Okay.
But it also helped teach our faculty who were CHS and clinical faculty in the department who were working with medical students. And it was a program that met in person about four times a year. And the faculty came from all over the state and then had projects that they would do. They would learn about resources of the university that they could use. They would learn teaching techniques, research techniques about human subjects protocols. And each faculty would have a project. And I did some of the research teaching and some of the human subjects teaching for that course.
Okay.
There were about maybe 15 people in a course, and over the course of a year, it would, and then they would go off and continue to work with our students after that.
Okay.
That program is actually still going. It's called PCFDF, Primary Care Faculty Development Program. And right now, John Tempty is in charge of it. I was never in charge of it. I was just one of the people who worked on, you know, with faculty. And as far as I know, it has not been renewed for next year. I don't know if HRSA is going in a different direction, but John has taken the program into a new direction and broadened the scope of it. And is working with people, even faculty, even from outside the state, are flying here now to be part of the program. And it continues to work to serve our own faculty and people who work with our own medical students also. But HRSA is has not funded it for next year. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I'm not really, since I'm not in the department anymore, I don't know what's really going on.
It's the cliche, out of the loop.
I'm out of the loop.
And towards the end, we'll talk about retirement and being out of the loop.
Oh.
You mentioned human subjects research. I see that on your resume that as part of your faculty or part of your service to campus that you were on an IRB.
Health sciences IRB. I was on two health sciences IRBs. I was on when HIPAA came out in the early part of 2000 something or other, maybe 2003 or 2004. They required more information in terms of medical records and how we treat medical records. And around that same time, the IRB instituted a minimal risk IRB. So the health, it was the health sciences minimal risk IRB. I was one of the, I was on that for, I'm guessing, I can't remember, it should say on my CV, about 5 years.
Yeah, I think that's what it said.
And
go ahead.
I also worked on a HIPAA committee, which tried to, you know, inform the IRB about how to think about HIPAA issues.
Mm-hmm.
So that IRB did most of the minimal risk reviews and applied HIPAA to the research. It's in a lot of ways because I also served on the health sciences IRB for about the past 4 or 5 years, until this fall, for about 5 years. That's an IRB that reviews randomized clinical trials and research that involves things like alcohol and drug abuse and domestic violence and, right, you know, the things that are considered more risky. But it's very interesting that, having served on both of them, it's really more difficult to be an IRB member of the minimal risk IRB, because people come to that IRB with research that hasn't been done before. Often it's in the community, it's asking questions that have never been asked before and doing protocols that have never been done, whereas a randomized clinical trial is often very straightforward. You know, we identify the patients or the subjects or potential subjects and randomize them to a drug or an intervention, and it's a very straightforward thing. But with the minimal risk IRB, the questions are always a lot more convoluted. The discussions were more intricate, and took longer. It was very interesting.
Yeah. Maybe just because we don't know for sure who's going to listen to this, IRB stands for Institutional Review Board.
Right.
And in your mind, or from what you learned about it, could you explain a little bit about what that is and why it's important, in your department?
Right. Well, it's important for the whole university because it protects the university and the researcher and the subjects of a research project, in that it looks at how we treat them, how we treat subjects, make sure that we don't put them at risk, or a risk that would be any higher than what they're currently living with right now. And that we follow the law and get people's consent. You know, there's certain things that you have to make sure that you're doing. Those are the main ones that I'm thinking of off the top of my head.
Okay.
And that the people understand what it is they're getting into.
Right. In oral history, we call it informed consent.
Right.
So we try to explain to them as much as we can what we're trying to do.
Exactly.
So when they sign the document that you and I are going to sign at the end, we have an understanding of what's going to be done.
Right. And that's exactly what the IRB does.
And the risks, I would venture, are far higher in the IRBs that you were a part of than the IRBs in the humanities or social sciences. But still, it's the idea of making sure that everybody's informed as to what the research is being done and used for.
Exactly.
And the effect on the person as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So when we last left off, we talked a little bit about academic staff at the end, but we also talked about the end of the HEART grant and you looking for and getting permanent employment within the Department of Family Health. And it looks like you started off as an associate scientist.
Right.
Is that your first permanent full-time position within Department of Family Health?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think we may have talked about this a little bit at the end of the last one, but if you could talk a little bit about what it meant, what that job description means, associate scientist.
Oh, sure. Well, in our department, it wasn't that I was doing scientific research necessarily of my own, but I was working with other people. I worked with the director of the research program, Dr. Mike Fleming, and worked with several investigators, writing grants, doing research on grant writing, monitoring grants, and managing them over the years. And that position grew from that position to one where I was really more the lead person in the research program. We didn't have a research director. Dr. Fleming was no longer the research director, and the department didn't replace him after much thought and conversation. And then I sort of became the lead person in the department, the lead go-to person for managing the research program. And around that time is probably when I became a senior scientist. So, you know, the position really grew over the years, and with more and more responsibility for administration,
Was that, so initially you're working under Dr. Fleming, and then were there other staff either working with or under you, or was it?
Actually, our department's research program was organized, and to a great degree still is, around the PIs, the principal investigators. So a principal investigator could be a faculty or it could be another scientist in the department, and who has their own research program. And they often will hire their own staff. And so it's a loosely organized group of people who are doing their own research, some of whom collaborate with each other, but mostly they had their own research, and their team worked for them. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of overlap over the years when senior investigators maybe were running short on a grant and somebody else that was a junior investigator came along and needed somebody part-time. Mm-hmm. And so then we would, you know, they would share their their staff with, and I would be one of the people who would try and figure that out. Okay. But we had several people who did alcohol research. Do you want to know what kinds of stuff was going on?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, Dr. Mike Fleming was a major researcher in brief intervention for alcohol, and he started out with some work that was done by some researchers in England whose name I can't remember because this was in like 1998. Doing brief intervention and thinking about how you could do brief intervention for alcohol. So he wrote, one of his first grants was called TREAT, and it trained physicians and their staff to do a brief intervention with their patients about alcohol. So it was a screening of how much do you drink, and then depending on the answer to that, I mean, it wasn't that brief, but it was an embedded questionnaire. You know, but it was a randomized controlled trial, actually, of randomizing physicians, you know, to do interventions with subjects. And they developed a workbook and did interventions with patients. And over time, they found out that actually people did decrease their drinking if they did this. And it not only decreased their drinking, but with some of the subsequent work that they did, it decreased their traffic tickets and their emergency room visits. So they did this with people who were primary care patients. They did it with new moms. So they had a Healthy Moms grant. They had a Goal grant, which was for older adults. So they showed that it worked with older adults. They moved on and over the years worked with college students and found that it worked with them too. And he also became interested in working internationally, so they did this project in Poland, and they did I mean, it was all, you know, little versions of it, but variations of it, but and in Russia. So that was a major part of his career. He also did he expanded into chronic pain, and was interested in chronic pain because it's very related to, you know, the questions are related to alcohol in terms of drug dependence and things like that, and did some work on chronic pain over the years to see if people who were living with chronic pain actually were more dependent on drugs than other people, and actually found out that they weren't. So anyhow, that was one. We have other alcohol researchers in the department. Dr. Rich Brown did a variation of a brief intervention and used motivational interviewing to work with subjects in primary care, and carried that work. It was called the TAMI Project, treatment, something about motivational interviewing. But anyhow, he took that and converted it into a NIH-funded service grant. And he actually hasn't, for the past 10 or 15 years, done research. He's done service implementation around the whole state and worked nationally and with not researchers, but people across the country in trying to get primary care physicians and their staff to look at how much people are drinking and actually do a brief intervention, a referral, and a treatment for people who actually need it.
You mentioned this motivational interviewing.
Right.
Do you know what that means?
Oh, sure. It's really based on two people called Prochaska and I forgot the other guy's name, who take a look at your stages of change, where you might be in terms of what you're thinking mm-hmm. about whether or not you want to change. And there's like four or five stages. I can't remember them all, but there's pre-contemplation. You're not even thinking about the fact you have a problem. Mm-hmm. Then you start thinking in contemplation that you have a problem. And then there's maybe planning. There's a little stage in there about, you know, I'm going to really do something about this. And then there's the other stage where you implement that. And then you go back and maybe you fall back into one of the stages. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a circular thing because, you know, there's maintenance at the end. How you maintain it, but you know you can fall back or you can leap ahead on the stages. It's, but anyhow, the motivational interviewing is based on that. So you see where somebody is in their stages of change. You know, do they think their drinking is a problem, and then does it affect? Is this affecting your family or is it affecting your job? Is there something you want to do about that? And so the motivational interviewing is really targeted very specifically at where the person is and their own life and what they decide they want to do about it, because that's the answer from the person is where they want to go. Mm-hmm. You know, so if this is affecting how they get up in the morning, you know, do they want to change their drinking behavior so they feel better mm-hmm. or so they don't have fights with their husband or their wife or something like that, you know, so that's the motivational part
okay.
of it.
Oh, okay.
Right. So that's what he does. He's working across the state. He's one of the people who worked very hard with the feds to make sure that Medicare covers this kind of screening and referral process. And that just happened within the past couple of years. So now that Medicare is starting to pay for this, he's working very hard to help people in primary care actually implement it in their, you know, in their practices.
Mm-hmm.
So we have another person who does alcohol research, who is Alexandra Zagurska, is doing right now mainly work on meditation and working with people who are coming out of alcohol treatment. So that would be residential treatment, and helping them meditate. Learn to meditate to see if that doesn't help them stay sober. And Dr. Randy Brown is another alcohol researcher. This is our major, you know, area, is an alcohol researcher, an alcohol and drug abuse researcher who mainly works with the courts and takes a look at or he tries to work with the court system to intervene with people who are in a diversion program. So can they get, you know, treatment for their drug abuse and the alcohol, and does that help them not be recidivist?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the main focus of his work. He also is has a new fellowship that is a clinical fellowship that will be training people to do more work like this. So, and then there's another alcohol researcher in our department by the name of Georgiana Wilton, and she works mainly with families and has done her major goal is to help people understand FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and work with families who are living with somebody who has this. Do you know what that is?
No.
Okay, well, what happens is that if a mom drinks too much sometimes during her pregnancy, a child can be born with this disorder. And there's ways of noticing this, and it's really a diagnosis of exclusion, and it's very difficult. But there's behavioral consequences to somebody who does, who has this, and they can't process information and learn it and retain it. So you could get into a behavioral pattern that showing that you can't learn in some ways, and that it's very difficult for families to deal with, you know, when somebody can't figure out that their behavior is something that they need to change. And so anyhow, her work is a lot with families who do this. She works with the Weissman Center, mm-hmm. also, and does work across the state and does training of professionals and of for families across the country. It's a regional, actually it's a regional thing, but to help people learn how to work with families who have FASD and to actually think about it when they're, you know, like say if it's a primary care doc, to think about the fact that this might be an issue, mm-hmm. you know, and then get them referred to the right place and then get families the kind of support that they need. Right. So that's a major part of our, there's two other major areas that we do research in our department, and then one that's growing. The first one would be with the American Indian tribes, and we have Alex Adams, Dr. Alex Adams, who works with four or five tribes around the state and spends an incredible amount of time developing research that with the tribes. So you know, they decide with her what it is their issues are. They mainly decide what the issues are, and then she brings the academic side to it. It's truly the Wisconsin idea, the way she's doing this. So the what they mainly have been working on is childhood obesity and prevention of obesity in adults that would lead to heart disease and diabetes. And she's been doing this for, well, she got tenure based on this work, mm-hmm. and has been doing it for, I would say, at least probably 15 years. She now is the director of the CCHE Center for, oh man, I can't remember what it is. CCHE is in the medical school, and it's actually... It has to do with health equity. It's cultural competence and health equity or something like that. Okay. So she's, which is partnering with ICTR, the Institute for Clinical and Translational Research at the medical school. And she really is a very good national leader and leader in the state of Wisconsin for this work. And she just got a new grant that brings this work to Montana, I think Arizona, it might be New Mexico, I can't remember which one, and Wisconsin and Minnesota. And there's another scientist who worked with her and now is a solo researcher named Tara LaRoe, Dr. Tara LaRoe, also does work with obesity, and she mainly works with the state of Wisconsin and does evaluation with some of the state programs on obesity in, I would say, like kindergartens and preschool, mm. you know, daycare centers, mm. and how they implement the work of the, how they can implement better nutrition and more exercise and that kind of thing into their programs. She also does other things like with gardens, school gardens and Troy gardens and things like that. And then the other work that's done in our department is complementary medicine. Dr. Bruce Barrett does started out by he's an anthropologist actually, but he in addition to being a physician, and has been interested in herbs and that kind of thing his whole life, and his first randomized controlled trial was testing echinacea to prevent the common cold here in Wisconsin, and he's done quite a bit of research on that. He developed an instrument called the WRS, the Wisconsin Upper Respiratory Survey, and it measures the common cold and the severity of it. And also right now is doing work on meditation and exercise and prevention of colds and flu. And Dr. David Ravigo does complementary medicine. He does two kinds. He has two major areas of research. One is prolotherapy. Do you know what that is? Mm-hmm. Okay, it's it treats tendonitis. So let's say you have tennis elbow. Okay, it takes a solution that's just it's a common, I don't know if it's saline solution or something, and you inject the area around the tendon or into the tendon, I'm not sure which, and it's quite painful, but it apparently works for quite a few people. And he's testing that on elbows and knees. And John Wilson took off with this. He now is not in our department anymore, but he went to sports medicine, but he's working on this. And he actually is using PRP, which is prolotherapy that uses your own blood as the injectant. So he does that, and David was the first person who did a randomized controlled trial using neti pots for sinusitis and showed that it worked and did quite a bit of work on that. So, the other research that we do that's growing in our department is taking a look at medical records and the information that's in medical records and learning from that. You know, asking questions about how well are we doing with patients who have, say, diabetes or asthma, and taking a look, and we're learning how to look at the natural history of diseases by looking back over the, you know, a medical record and things like that. And the other thing that they're using medical records for is for us a physician to take a look at their own practice. Okay, so I've got this, you know, these 2,000 people or 3,000 people that I'm their physician, and what are the most common problems or you know, like for, in the case of asthma, do they all live in the same area, and do we want to, you know, what would that tell us about, you know, if we you know, maybe had a group, could we set up a group over here of people who have asthma and who would want to meet, you know, or would we want to take a look at the environment there? You know, is there a reason that so many people in this area have asthma? So, you know, it's sort of like learning about your patient population, matching that with data that's publicly available from, like, say, the state, you know, mm-hmm. And then learning and going back and forth with them to manage. It's more of a public health approach so it's sort of like a little, you know, snippet of the kinds of things that we did in family medicine, and what my job was to help people manage that, you know, manage that program.
So as they were either getting grants or trying to get grants, as a either associate scientist or senior scientist, you would work with them through the various steps of the process.
Yeah, some of that, right, especially at the beginning, but towards the end, they were mainly having their own staff do this, because we grew it a little bit. One of the things that I was conscious of was that I wasn't going to be there forever. Mm-hmm. And so we hired a grants manager. She's been there for probably 4 years now, and she's probably taken over much of that, you know, in terms of budgets and things like that. But for many years I did it, and since she's been there, I've backed off on that, and she's done more of that. And the physicians do most of their own rating. I often will review a grant, you know, make sure that they get reviewed. Sometimes help people write articles. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't write them, but I could review them and stuff like that. There's another piece of this job that I did that was more of, you know, I was really more management. This is what's, you know, to try and make sure people were hired, and that if there were personnel issues, and, you know, point people in the direction of opportunities, and help with budgets and that kind of thing. But we grew the research program to provide services You know, so the grant manager was one. Mm-hmm. We had a secretary who we hired. It was she was a program assistant, actually, who helped manage the fellowship programs. We had several fellowship programs, and I can go into that if you want me to.
Yeah, if you want to finish your thought here, right. And then we talk about the fellowship
okay. program, it'd be good too. We developed the services in that we had a scientist. He started out as a analyst and got his degree, became a scientist. He got his PhD, became a scientist. And he was a person who was our statistician that we went to, in addition to some of the people that we've gone to outside the department. So he was he helped people do the stats part of the grants. We had two other people in the department that help with minor stats, who actually were funded on other grants, but we would have them do, the department would pay them a little bit to do, you know, smaller projects that people who weren't major researchers were doing. And and then we also have, we worked with the faculty who are CHS faculty who have to do academic work. And that we would meet with them and say, you know, if they had a project that they wanted to do. And it could be a research project. It wouldn't have to be research. It could have been an educational project or something like that, just to help people think through the project, you know, figure out their methods and how they were going to write it and things like that. So we developed that service for the department over the years, over the years that I was there.
So a project management function?
Yeah, it was really more of a consulting thing because people, we at first, before we ran out of money, we were even providing staff for some projects. You know, if somebody had a project that they wanted to do, we could provide a, we had a research specialist who was part-time paid by the department to do some of that work, to help collect data and manage the data. And we still do data management for faculty.
Okay. So you wanted to talk, or you said you would talk about the fellowship.
Oh right, but before I go there, sure. We have there has been for years a small grant program in the department. So if somebody had it could have been anybody who was a faculty or a staff, if they had a small project that they wanted to do, we could fund it for up to $4,000. So you could pay a student or, you know, collect data, buy a license for a measurement instrument, something like that. So we would do that for many years. The program has grown a bit in that we didn't at first pay any faculty for their time to do any projects like that. But now it's grown into a faculty can write a grant and then apply for time, you know, for a certain length of time. This is what I'm going to do on this project, and the department would fund that. So that's gotten bigger, and it's not just research anymore. It was research only until about 4 years ago, and now it can be an educational project, a community project. You know, as long as it's academic and it helps a faculty towards their academic work and their promotion.
Okay.
So we manage that program.
Okay, great.
So the fellowships we had. Since I was working for the Heart Project, there's been a primary care research fellowship, and it's been in conjunction. We've always led the project, the grant. We've always written the grant out of our department, and it's been in collaboration at first with pediatrics and internal medicine, and then it grew to collaborate with other departments, mainly population health now, but those are the main departments. But we have faculty now who come from a variety of departments because our faculty is becoming more collaborative with other departments in all of the work that we talked about, you know. They're working with people from other departments often. So the primary care fellowship is probably the most successful primary care fellowship in the country. And I can't remember how many K awards, you know, our fellows have written.
What's that?
And a K award is an award funded by NIH to a new researcher. And it's a grant that if you get it, you're in a mentoring relationship. So you have to find a mentor, you have to identify your own project, and then do a research project. It's usually a five-year grant. It can be only three, but it's usually up to 5 years. And you identify a research project that you want to learn how to do research with. And then also, there's two parts of it. There's the research part, and then there's the education part. So you have to have an education plan and a research plan. And a mentor, and a mentoring committee, but you have to have a primary mentor who really knows the area that you're in. So that's actually how Bruce Barrett and David Robigel both got their starts. Their first research projects were K awards.
Mm-hmm. And are we talking the letter K?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, the letter K.
And is that, you said that was NIH?
Mm-hmm.
NIH?
Yeah, a different, you know, the different branches of NIH, but, and there's different Ks. There's a K08 and a K01 and a K, but, you know, I can't remember what they all stand for.
So is this the primary care, yep, research fellowship? Is that the only fellowship that you...
That's the main one that we've had for going on 20 years in the department. For a while, Mike Fleming had an NIAAA training fellowship. It's a, actually they're called T32s. It's a training award. So we call them fellows, but they're really trainees legally in the university. So Mike Fleming had an NIAAA T32 award that trained people to do research in alcohol prevention. He had that for maybe 10 years. And then when he retired, that grant went away. And we have several departmental funded training fellowships. Mm-hmm. And one is a complementary medicine fellowship, and one is a academic fellowship. The academic fellowship is really to train people to be good faculty members. And the complementary medicine fellowship is to train people, it's really a more clinical academic fellowship to train people in complementary medicine, because we have some of the best complementary medicine people in the country in our department. And then, as I mentioned before, Randy Brown just started a clinical fellowship in alcohol. That's a one-person fellowship. But we have a total of, boy, I don't know, I would say 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, between 15 and 20 fellows at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And so you talked about the sort of the major aspects of Department of Family Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple things I wanted to talk about that you said were more minor things, but there are things that sort of jumped out at me, mm-hmm, as I was reading through your resume. The first is that it looked like you did some work, again, either it was presentations or you were a joint author on issues of domestic violence.
Right.
I don't know if you mind talking about why you're interested in that.
Oh, sure.
And what those...
Sure. In my life before I came to the university, I was a protective services social worker, and which is actually the reason I went back to school, is to learn more about why we were doing what we were doing out in the field, because the research wasn't there as to often how to help people who are survivors of sexual assault or domestic violence or children violence. And I've been interested in that all my life. So when I went through the doctoral program, the master's degree in the doctoral program here at UW, and it really wasn't involved in domestic violence then. But once I graduated and got a job in family medicine, I was still interested in that, and I could tell that my job wasn't going to necessarily be revolving around domestic violence. But I formed an affiliation with different people who were service providers in Madison, and one was Jane Raymond, who was the lead person for elder abuse for the state of Wisconsin, and through her became involved in the governor's task force against domestic violence, and was on the budget committee for many years. In fact, I'm probably still on it. It's not been as active as lately because there's no money in the budget, but so I was on that committee, and my job on that committee was really to make sure that we were paying attention to elder abuse in the budget. I also worked with people from both the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault on writing grants for them, you know, grants that they wrote to be funded, and then I worked with people from the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence on training to be physicians, you know, like residents and medical students about domestic violence, and actually was the head of a grant that Susan Skoshelak wrote. She was a dean over at the medical school and got too busy to manage that grant, so I took that grant over for her and was the PI on it for a while. And the whole purpose of that grant was to train medical students and residents on domestic violence. So I did that, actually. I was part of that training and getting people from the community into medical student education and residency education until I left.
Okay. The other one is...
The chlamydia and pneumonia?
Yeah, the title jumped out at me, so let me make sure I read it. Right. If I can find it. Is chlamydia pneumonia a missing link in the, quote, Dutch hypothesis in chronic non-specific lung disease?
Yeah. that's really part of a whole piece of work that was started by Dr. David Hahn, who actually is not, he is right now a member of our department, but he was a community physician who had the idea that he wanted to find out what was causing asthma. And he was seeing asthma as a really big problem in his practice. And so he started out by doing a card study of sort of like the history of asthma or how physicians think about treating asthma. Mm-hmm. And that was probably in the early 90s that he did that. And over the years, it formed a hypothesis that he could see that if he gave people azithromycin, that their asthma got better. And there's several hypotheses that could account for this, but none of them have been proven. One is that azithromycin is a drug that reduces inflammation. So your lungs open up a little bit when you take it. And the other is that it also kills, I mean, it's an antibiotic, so it kills chlamydia and pneumonia. Mm-hmm. And David had the hypothesis over the years. I mean, he's been thinking about this for a long time. And in the early, around 2000, 2003, something like that, he did a pilot study, a randomized controlled trial pilot of azithromycin in treating asthma, people who had adult onset asthma, to see if it would help. And the pilot studies were quite, they were quite promising. It's really hard to do this research in primary care, but he and I wrote a couple of articles based on that pilot work, and he, as part of that pilot work, he collected samples of people's spit and nasal washes and stuff like that. And so they thought that this might be a good hypothesis to test. And so that's part of that work. He and I wrote a couple of grants to try and get the feds to fund it, but the people who are in charge of asthma research don't see this hypothesis as being fruitful. at least at this point, and so they never funded his research. He's still working on it.
Mary Beth, is there anything else you want to say about the... we're sort of doing the last half of your time here, 88 to up to your retirement. Anything else jumping out at you as we're talking?
I don't know. Okay. Can't think of anything.
Then I want to ask, why retire when you did?
Oh, why did I retire when I did? Well, I was actually planning to work a couple more years and wasn't really ready to retire, but my husband got sick and had a very long year and a half of cancer treatment and illness, and he's in remission right now. And we decided that we wanted to have some good time together. And I think after that year and a half, I was pretty tired, you know, working full-time and you know, the pressures of living with his illness and stuff. And we just decided that it was time to retire.
Okay.
For me. I mean, he had retired right before he had his cancer diagnosis. And so a year and a half later is pretty much when I retired.
Mm-hmm. And how long officially, I can't remember, we met?
I started in 1987. Is that what you're asking?
When did you officially retire?
October 12th.
All right.
So. Of 2012.
So just a little over 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Might be too early to ask this question, but how are you, I guess I'll ask it this way, do you miss the work that you did? There's aspects of it that you miss?
But you know, it's surprising how fast I've let go of it, given how involved in it I was. I still go back occasionally for two reasons. One is to work with the person who has replaced me, and some of the faculty who are researchers, you know, just on some of the projects that I know something about, and you know, mm-hmm. just to get Larry up and running on how I thought about my job. The way what they hired him for is not exactly what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
He's really more into the, you know, where I said the department was going in terms of medical records research and big databases, mm-hmm. and linking those to public resources and stuff like that. He used to work for the state and actually did some of that kind of work before. So he brings that to the department in a new way. And the other thing that they've asked me to do is work with the junior faculty, of whom we have quite a few. We had a whole influx of new junior faculty, and in thinking about their projects, you know, their the way they're going to get their academic work up and running. So I'm going back sometimes once a week. There's some weeks I don't go in at all, you know, to meet with people depending on their schedules. And so I would say probably, you know, 15 hours a month so far. So it's minimal. Maybe a little more than that.
I want to give you one more opportunity if there's anything that's on your mind that you want to talk about before we wrap this up.
Well, you know, I saw family medicine change really a lot over the years in the time that I was there. And it seems like, just like in everything else in this world, money has taken over thinking of the people who administer the university and the medical school and the department. It comes down, you know, directly from the legislature, and it feels like the money is more important than the work. In terms of funding, you know, I said we built the research program and the services that were part of it to help people become more productive and write grants, and you know, from I think that did work. You know, we saw our research program grow from like one grant when I first started up to, you know, millions of dollars. And then with the senior faculty writing grants, you know, and then tapered off when they both stopped. Those, the two major, Rich Brown and Mike Fleming, stopped writing grants for research. And then the new faculty, I think that the services that we started building and providing them, I think that helped us get from like $3 million a year up till $7, $8, $9 million a year now. Mm-hmm. And it's just growing. So I find it unfortunate that the, you know, that money has to drive what it does. Mm-hmm.
So I guess, and by that, do you mean that?
I think it's productivity, clinical productivity. Is uppermost in the minds of the faculty, and that's how they make their money. And being a researcher, that makes it really, really hard for faculty in the research program, because they have a fixed income on their research side, and they aren't productive in terms of clinical research, and the dollars for research are different. And you get, it gets accounted for differently. The other thing that I find that I think is unfortunate is that family medicine is seen as sort of like a stepchild of the medical group, and is seen as costing the medical community rather than bringing in money. Mm-hmm. And I really think that it's really part of a whole enterprise, and it's part of the cost of doing business to provide medical care is to provide services in primary care. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how specialists get their patients. That's how they're referred, you know. And I would really like to see something happen in terms of family medicine being seen as the integral part of providing care that it is. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of funding, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And we didn't get into any of that, but that really wasn't part of my job. It's just that I've seen it over the years, and that's on my mind about how we deliver medical care in this country. I really hope that, you know, the new laws will help that. And I think they will, because the new accountable care, the way the accountable care organizations are being organized now, it's going to have to pay more attention to primary care.
Okay. Well, unless you have...
don't have anything else I can think of.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for your time this evening. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
It.